Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. If you just joined us, boy, we had a great first hour. Carmen LaBurge is always awesome. She's so interesting. And then Alex McFarland was with us, and he is always so thoughtful. So if you want to go to myfaithradio.com, we will be posting those interviews a little bit later in the day, and you can catch up if you missed it. And this hour is going to be great. Skye Jathani is going to be with us. He's an author of about 6 books, and we're going to have a discussion with him in just a minute. And then Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical, he is going to be in such a good mood. He is one of the most rabid Chicago Cubs fans. And the Cubbies won last night in Washington, eked it out 9-8. Exciting game, and Chris will be beside himself. So I'm going to start with a passage out of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, starting in verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may also be revealed in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. So it's a great verse for today. I want you to get yourself into God's Word today and make time for it. And sometimes you think, well, I'm really busy today, and I say, no, you're not too busy. Get some time with the Lord, and that's very, very important to get your day started. So anyway, 6 minutes after the hour, we're going to talk to Skye when we get back in just a minute.
Are gonna clear up, put on a happy face,
brush off those clouds and cheer up.
You get it. Put on.
But. Good morning. It is 7 minutes after the hour. Skye Jathani is an award-winning author, speaker, and ordained pastor. He served as both the managing and senior editor of Leadership Journal and as the director of Mission Advancement for Christianity Today. He also currently co-hosts the Phil Vischer podcast and regularly contributes to the Huffington Post. He's authored 6 books. He's got a new one out. We're so glad to have him on the program this morning. Good morning, Skye.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Congratulations on a book. Is this number 6 or number 7?
Yeah, I don't know how you count them anymore with e-books and things like that. So
yeah, who knows?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. And the book is entitled, What's Wrong with Religion? 9 Things No One Told You About Faith. Very interesting
right.
title. And
I wanted it to be able to be read either way. Like, what's wrong with religion? There's nothing wrong with it. Or if you're a skeptic, what's wrong with religion? Kind of, let's unpack why this is such a problem.
Yeah. But in the culture today, religious is much less popular, especially with the young. But you say everyone is religious. What do you mean?
Yeah, it's an argument that actually comes from an old theologian named Paul Tillich, who said to be human is to be religious because everybody has something of ultimate concern, something that directs their life or that they're motivated by. And to put it in biblical language, we all have a God, we all have an idol, and we just need to be honest about what that is and how much power it has over our life. So the question is not, are you religious or non-religious, but what God or which God are you worshiping?
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to level the playing field to say, this is a universal human endeavor. We just need to be honest about the outcomes of which God we've chosen.
Yeah. We don't like anything that threatens our self-sovereignty, do we?
No, not at all. I mean, the idea of surrendering to anyone or anything is almost poisonous to us in our demeanor. But and the argument here is not that all religions are the same. It's arguing that there is a fundamental difference between the message of Jesus Christ and the outcomes of a life in pursuit of him versus a life in pursuit of any other God.
Mm-hmm. Scott, you said that Christopher Hitchens, who's a very popular atheist, he said that religion kind of ruins everything, and you don't seem to disagree. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the foundational, when I was a college student, I went to the state university, a large state university. I studied comparative religion, traveled real broadly. I saw a lot of different religious expressions. And frankly, when I would come back to the United States and I would see popular American evangelicalism, I didn't see anything that was ultimately all that different from the religious traditions. Let me explain. In my view, religion is all rooted in the same thing, which is the fact that we live in a dangerous world. And like an organism that's under threat, we respond to that danger through fight or flight. We either want to run away from the danger and protect ourselves or fight against the danger. But both fight and flight are a means of trying to gain control over a dangerous world. And what religion does, at least human religion does, is it gives us that illusion of control. And if the world's dangerous and I don't know what's going to happen and I can't predict the future, well, then maybe I'll just say these prayers or I'll offer these sacrifices or I'll do these rituals. And the God or gods who control the world will make sure it goes the way I want. That is what human religion does in all of its different forms. And when Christopher Hitchens says that religion ruins the world, I think he's right, because the more we try to control the world, ironically, the more dangerous it becomes. And we end up fighting wars and trying to control people and control populations and manipulate others in order to make sure that our fears are mitigated through this desire for control. And when you look at history, religion has done that in a lot of places, and it's resulted in a lot of pain and evil and suffering. The difference is, I would argue that the message of Jesus does not follow that pattern. He is not calling us to just another means of control. He's not reinforcing the idea that the world is a dangerous place. And when properly understood and lived, the Christian life is different than these other systems of control, and it doesn't make the world a worse place. It actually breaks that cycle of control and danger that all the other religious traditions and worldviews reinforce.
Mm-hmm. Sky, you also talk about some Christians will talk about the church and say that the church needs to be more missional, but you want to warn that expression might be more pagan than Christian. You'll need to explain that one.
Yeah, I know. This is one that will certainly get church leaders feathers ruffled.
Oh, sure.
I'm not against the mission by any means. In fact, I'm ordained in the Christian Missionary Alliance, so the mission is important. The problem is we often will take what is a very good thing, like the mission, and we can make it into an ultimate thing, in which case it becomes an idol. And the reason why I say missionalism can become closer to paganism than Christianity is when you go back and look at the ancient creation myths of pagan cultures, whether the Mesopotamians or the Greeks or the Egyptians, they all have a common theme. And that is, they say that humans were created by the gods in order to be the gods' servants, in order to supply the gods with food through sacrifices or to build them temples or to fight their wars. In other words, the gods are these kind of petty, insecure beings that can't really accomplish everything they need. So they created these ugly, smelly things called people, and they're going to be their servants and slaves. The Christian creation story, the Jewish creation story in the Hebrew Bible is fundamentally different, because in Genesis 1 and 2, it's clear that God did not create humanity because he needed us or because we were to be his slaves to accomplish something he couldn't otherwise do. It's clear in the scriptures that he created us to be his representatives and gave us great dignity, and that through us, the world would recognize who God is. So when we then pick up this theme that we're to be slaves, and of course Paul uses that language, but I think he uses it in a slightly different way, or when we reinforce the idea that your primary value to God is your usefulness, that he merely redeemed you in order to use you to accomplish some mission, I think it does two things. Number one, it severely reduces our vision of who God is. If you believe that God needs you to accomplish something, then he is not a God worthy of your worship. He's just not big enough. And then secondly, it diminishes human value, because it tends then to view yourself and everyone else through a utilitarian ethic that says a person's value is rooted in their usefulness. And that's scary to me, frankly, as a Christian, because we have always stood for the belief that every human being is inherently worthy of life and dignity, regardless of their usefulness, which is the foundation for being pro-life, for being pro-human in every way. So when I see this missionalism talk really ramped up a lot in the church, I think it's done for a good reason, because we want to see the gospel advance, or we want to see the culture transformed. What we inadvertently communicate to people is that their value is rooted in their usefulness to the mission. And that's actually a pagan vision of humanity and God rather than a Christian one. By all means, let's engage the mission because God has invited us to and called us to, but we can't attach our value to that or the value of other people.
Hmm. That is some deep thinking, Sky. I'm going to take a break, and when I come back, I want to ask the question about Christians who focus on heaven or hell. And is that the right gospel? Are we getting that gospel right? That's the cliffhanger. We'll be back in just a minute speaking to Sky Jathani. We'll be back. It is 15 minutes after the hour. Good morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Sky Jathani. He is a award-winning author and speaker, and he's going to be in Minneapolis here for the Fuel Leadership Conference here at Northwestern, November 19th. And I promise Sky will have less than 19 inches of snow by then.
I hope so.
Yeah. So I loaded up this serious question, and I want to just lay it out there. How are Christians who focus on heaven or hell getting the gospel wrong?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot I could say on this one, but let me boil it down to this. One of the fundamental ways that we get the gospel wrong, or frankly, we get Jesus wrong, is our instinct, particularly as 21st century consumeristic Americans, is to reduce Jesus to a device. We make him into a tool that we employ to achieve some other goal. So we recognize the danger of this in extreme forms like the prosperity gospel. If we say, my real goal is to get a BMW, and I'm just going to employ Jesus as a means by which I'm going to get that BMW, we recognize that that's a bad gospel. That's a false way of engaging with the Lord. But really, we do the same thing. What you just change the goal. Okay, the goal is no longer a BMW. The goal is heaven, or the goal is avoiding hell. But we're going to use Jesus to get to heaven, or we're going to use Jesus to avoid hell. That's the same problem. You're reducing Jesus to a means to an end, when the overwhelming message he brought throughout the Gospels is that he himself is the goal. And sell all you have and come follow me, he told the rich young ruler. This is life, that you believe in me. And what a lot of our presentation of the gospel gets wrong is it reduces Jesus to a means to an end. It's how I get to heaven rather than the goal. That this is how John Piper put it. And there's a number of things that I disagree with John Piper with over the years, but on this, I think he's absolutely correct. He said, the gospel is not how people get to heaven. The gospel is how people get to God. And if you would be happy in heaven if Jesus were not there, you will not be there. So what we need to get straight is, when we're presenting the gospel to somebody, whether it's a child or an adult, rather than giving them a horrific vision of what hell might be like or this ravishing vision of what heaven would be like, what we need to present is this beautiful, compelling vision of what Jesus is like. He's the point of all of this. It's not about escaping punishment or getting to heaven. It's about getting to Jesus. And if you don't actually want Jesus, then the gospel is useless to you. It's of no help whatsoever. So that's a major missing component in the way we read Scripture and in our tradition of the Bible and in our tradition of faith, is we've emphasized heaven but de-emphasized Jesus. Mm. And anytime we reduce Jesus to merely a means, a how-to, a tool that we employ, we are doing violence against the gospel that he brought.
Oh, I'm going to think about that one all day, Sky. I know a lot of Christians today feel that their faith is really under attack, but you will say that the world is a perfectly safe place. Why is that?
Yeah, the first time I heard that idea from a philosopher and theologian, I thought he was crazy. The most common commandment in the Bible, Old and New Testament, is do not be afraid. And the message of Jesus, a lot of it, from the time his birth is announced, right, he is Emmanuel, God with us. And over and over and over again, he has to tell his disciples, don't be afraid. You know, the storm rages on the sea, with a word he calms it. He says, why are you afraid? I'm here. At the end, before he leaves them, after the resurrection, he says, in this world you will have much trouble, but take courage. I have overcome the world. And I will be with you to the very end of the age. Again and again and again, the message is, yeah, this world appears really dark and evil and dangerous, but it's a God with us world. And as Paul says in Romans 8, there is nothing in all of creation, angels or demons or heights or depths or life or death, nothing that can ever separate us from the love of God in Christ. So if nothing can possibly separate us from God, and this is a God with us world, the fact is, despite all appearances, we are indeed perfectly safe. Not even death do any ultimate harm to us. And it's only when we come to recognize that truth that we can be set free from that instinct that I talked about earlier to try to control everything,
mm-hmm.
to try to manipulate everything. It's only when we are safe in the hands of God, who has proven his love for us by sending his own son to die in our place. I mean, what greater sign could he give us that he loves us? If we completely trust that, we now become the most dangerous people in the world.
Wow.
Because now we are set free to love our enemies, even if they kill us.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to forgive those who've wronged us. We're able to give to the one who asks of us. All those commandments that Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, which on the surface appear crazy and nonsensical, they suddenly begin to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're still trapped in this vision of the world as a dangerous place in which I have to fight for control or run away in fear or manipulate to get things to go the way I want, you're going to find the commands of Jesus impossible to follow. And frankly, my greatest concern for the American church is that we are captivated by fear. When you look at the way we approach our neighbors, politics, the culture, the future, our children, over and over and over again, so many so-called Christian voices are trying to lead us by making us more afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And in my view, they are not leading us by the Spirit of God.
Yeah.
Because we have not been given a spirit of fear.
Scott, we've only got about a minute and a half left, and I still have 71 more questions. So this is going to be tricky. Your book's subtitle is 9 Things No One Told You About Faith. Why are these ideas so unfamiliar to us, and really, how did you discover them?
Well, I think they're unfamiliar to us because our default posture is to go back to mere human religion. That mere cycle of control and danger and fear that drives us in our faith, we just put a Christian veneer on it instead of a Buddhist veneer or a Muslim veneer or a Hindu mm-hmm. veneer. And so these 9 ideas are all rooted in Scripture, but they're so often counterintuitive. Just as when Jesus taught, so many people look at him like, this is weird stuff. We've never heard this before.
Right.
Because it completely contradicts our instincts. Yeah, the world is a safe place? That's ridiculous. How can you say that, Jesus? Or the kingdom is here among us? Look at what's going on. You're being nailed to a cross. How can you say that?
Right.
Well, these are counterintuitive ideas. And so if we don't intentionally and repeatedly put them in front of people, even in our own churches, we are going to default back to mere human religion,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't ultimately change the world or help us in any way. So that's why they're things people haven't heard before, even though they're rooted in Scripture.
Yeah. Of course, the name of the book is What's Wrong with Religion, 9 Things No One Told You About Faith. So what's your hope for the book?
Well, my deepest hope is that people would come to a vibrant, living communion with Jesus and that he himself would be their greatest desire, their greatest goal,
mm-hmm.
rather than using him to achieve something else or feeling like God merely wants to use them to achieve something else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big one. And then secondly, on a more communal scale, is to see the church be set free and liberated from its captivity to fear. Because I think that's the only way our world gets changed.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with the church. It starts when we are living in the gospel and we are set free from those fears. So we don't have to control our neighbors or our culture or our society and say we can love it and serve it and bless it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the 2 things I really long for most.
Yeah. And Scott, my last question is, what model BMW are you praying for?
Now, I would love a classic little 2-seat roadster, but I'm not anticipating that that's the goal of my faith.
You've really got us thinking this morning. And again, the book is What's Wrong with Religion, 9 Things No One Told You About Faith by Scott Jathani. And you're going to be in town November 19th. Maybe you can swing by the studio and we can talk to you some more.
I would love that. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, Scott. Thanks so much. Have a great day. It's 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be back.
The Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio, you just might find yourself saying, I can't wait to get up early. Yeah, of course, we're kidding.
It is half past the hour. Good morning. It's Friday the 13th. Big deal. We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to talk to Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical, and boy, is he in a good mood. And I'll tell you why in just a minute. Good morning. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. Ed Welsh says that when we have our confidence in Christ, we don't have to feel anxious when interacting with others.
I'm sure there are many people who have good convictions who are in the political arena, but if we were less concerned with ourselves, with winning or losing, and certainly so much of politics is winning or losing, and if there is this... Okay, let's say a Christian in politics, where winning and losing no longer becomes the most important thing. We are settled on Jesus, and what more do we need? And out of that secure position, there can be this quiet, resting humility. And humility is willing to listen to the other side of the fence. It hears, it listens, it says the other people, there's a reason for why they say such things. I want to understand them. There's that wonderful sort of lack of self-consciousness. And what are people going to do? Are they going to manipulate me? And that freedom to be truly human, and to be truly human is to move toward other people with humility. So people will still have differences of opinion, absolutely, in the political world, but I think you're getting it at how we actually adjudicate when there are those differences of opinion. And humility, that's one of the things we're after right here.
More of that is available at myfaithradio.com. Type in the search engine Ed Welsh, and you'll get a chance to hear that interview in its entirety. We'll take just a very short break, and then when we come back, Chris Martin's with us, and we've got something to tell you that is very exciting. Be back in a minute.
When was the last time you humbled yourself and spoke those two giant words, "I'm sorry"? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. I once witnessed an entire family break down and sob when the father asked each member to forgive him for the way he'd handled himself in their relationship. It was a humble, sincere apology. Every heart in the room melted, and anger and resentment began to lift. I challenge you to take the dad's example. It's time to start steering your home in the right direction and fostering respect in those you love. Your teen may seem like a fortress with high walls and a locked gate, impenetrable, but seeking forgiveness may unlock the door to his or her heart. Just say those two powerful words, "I'm sorry."
Find more help from Mark Gregston at ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
It is 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Chris Martin, our friend, our millennial evangelical friend, is with us this morning, and I know for a fact he is exhilarated and exhausted. Two big E words. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you guys this morning?
Well, we're good, but not as good as you. And tell our listeners maybe why.
Yeah, sure. So I want to start by how my day went yesterday.
Okay.
If that's okay.
No,
I'm going to tell
a brief
story.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So I got into work at 6 o'clock in the morning, which on a typical day is when I'm usually starting to work. And so I was in the office at 6. I was working this conference for Lifeway yesterday, which is where I work. If you don't know that, listeners, if you've not heard before, I work at Lifeway in Nashville. I was working this conference and I was going to be working until like 9:30 last night. So I was going to be working like a 15-hour day.
Okay.
I had to get there early to get stuff done. And my job yesterday was to actually escort and kind of host a guy from your guys' neck of the woods, Pastor John Piper. And I was like driving him and making sure he was in where he needed to be for the conference and everything yesterday. I get in the car at 9:30. I turn the game on my phone and listen to it. And I'm listening to the Chicago Cubs game. And I heard the most wacky half inning of baseball I've ever heard in the top of the fifth last night. Came home, listened to the rest of the game. Dozed off in the eighth inning, woke back up for the ninth inning, and the Cubs won and beat the Nationals and are going to the National League Championship Series to face the Dodgers, and I am exhausted.
But
and
exhilarated.
Still mentally recovering. It's going to take at least the whole day today to process all of the emotions I had listening to that game last night.
Oh, it was insane, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Other than Game 7 of the World Series yesterday, last year. Game 7 of the World Series last year, it was the craziest baseball game I've ever listened to, like, firsthand.
Yeah, and I know you are very much a Cubs fan, so I just want to let all of our listeners know this is why he is so passionate about the Cubs, because you are a very diehard fan. All right, let's talk a little bit about the high school experience. Now, you haven't been out of high school that long. I mean, are you 26 right now?
Yep, 26.
Well, 26. So the experience that happens in the hallways is almost as significant as what happens in the classrooms.
Yeah, yeah. You know, anyone who's been to high school, which is probably most of the people listening, I doubt we have many middle schoolers listening, but perhaps we do. When you're in high school, a lot of the most significant interactions you have with people take place in the hallway or in the lunchroom, not even in the classroom. And obviously the education we get in high school is pretty foundational. If you hope to do further education, you really rely on what you learn in high school to help you in further education. Even if you don't do further education and high school is the last level of education you have, you kind of rely on that for the rest of your life. And so obviously education in high school is important, but what happens in the hallways is arguably just as, if not more important in shaping who we are as people. And today, I would argue, and I'm not the only one that argues this, there are plenty of researchers and people who are far smarter than me who say this, but I would say teens today are always in the hallway. And I don't mean physically in high schools. I haven't been in a high school in a number of years. I can't say if teens hang out in the hallways physically more than they used to. But the interactions, the social interactions that happen in the hallway that define the sort of social hierarchy in a high school are always taking place even once school is over and the students have left the building today because of how students are using their cell phones.
Mm-hmm. You said in your article, because I was reading your blog at millennialevangelical.com, you said that the average high school student, the hallway is as high a pressure of a performance environment as a catwalk would be to a model or the weight room to a football player.
Yeah.
Those are high stakes.
Yeah. I mean, if you read some of the stories, like there's a book I'm reading right now called iGen by Jean Twenge, I think mm-hmm. is how you say her last name. She's a researcher of iGen, which is what she's dubbed the Gen Z, the millennial, the generation that's following millennials that are kind of in high school, middle school, late elementary school right now. She's written a book on them with some of the earliest credible research on that generation and how they think and act and all of that. And I'm slowly reading through it right now. It's pretty heavy, but it's fantastic. Catch it on Amazon if you're interested in studying like demographics at all. But she has the whole book is really focused on that generation, and a lot of it's focused on how smartphones are defining them mm-hmm. because they really are in so many ways. She shows a ton of research about how basically there's a positive direct correlation between depression and how much time teens spend on their phones,
mm-hmm.
and which is really sad, but not at all surprising. And it's not just like they're depressed because they're looking at a screen, but it's because of what they're doing and engaging with when they're on that screen.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things that are happening to teens today, and this is kind of what I mean when I say today's teens are always in the hallway. Like, they're always having to perform. They're always having to save face and make themselves look cool, whether it be on – and it's usually via a social media platform of some kind,
mm-hmm.
whether that's like a private messaging service just via texting or like – What a lot of people may not even understand about me is like, yeah, I'm young in respect to, you know, a lot of people would say I'm a young person still at 26.
Mm-hmm.
But texting in high school for me, like we were just like if you had a camera phone, you were high tech.
Mm-hmm.
Like and I've only been removed from high school for like what, like 9 years.
Yeah.
I was a senior in high school 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a vastly different environment than today than it was for me. So these students are having to constantly perform via texting and all of the multimedia options that are available there. But then also, obviously, things like Snapchat or Instagram. So many of the social media platforms that younger people are using, you know, they're not as active on Facebook or Twitter, perhaps, as they are on Instagram and Snapchat, which are completely image-based. Mm-hmm. And we're silly if we don't recognize the fact that that's going to have an effect on how teens view themselves.
Mm-hmm. Chris, let me take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the things you've been looking at in Derek Thompson's book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. You've had some observations about that I find interesting. I'm talking to Chris Martin, our friend, the millennial evangelical. We'll take a short break. It's 14 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back in a minute. Good morning. Welcome back to the show. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Chris Martin, our friend, the millennial evangelical. And Chris, I don't know what makes things popular. I'm a little bummed. The viral video I made has almost no views. I don't get it.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's not a viral video then.
Well, I don't know. I'm not going to argue this point with you. You're the expert on this. But what makes some songs just explode and others just fizzle? And how does that work?
Yeah, there's so many factors. You know, Derek Thompson in his book Hitmakers, which is not at all like a spiritual book of any kind. You won't find it in like a Lifeway store or mm-hmm. any other Christian bookstore you may go to. But it's kind of like a businessy kind of book like that a friend recommended to me just because it has an effect on how we do like social media and things like that. And so I read it and it's super interesting just to study like how people work and how they think and how things get popular. Basically what he says in the book is there's no definitive one thing that makes things popular. There are a number of factors. There's the current cultural climate. There's the context, the geographical context of something. There's usually what he says is, you know, because I work in social media and a lot of times people I work with who I'm trying to help with their social media, they'll say, well, what can you do to just get something of mine to go viral? And I'm like, well, yeah. So there's this magic formula that if you just follow it, it doesn't work that way. A lot of going viral or getting popular is luck or happenstance or just a number of circumstances that all have to come together that you can't really orchestrate and that mm-hmm. you may not even know are factors. So some songs explode and that aren't very like good musically, and then others fizzle, maybe just because they had some influencers backing them up or mm-hmm. Or the person who produced the song has some good connections, or, you know, maybe it just got picked up by a radio DJ who didn't really know what to play that night. And then voila, it becomes this hit. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's really interesting. But in the sort of new age of smartphones, the popularity of everything changes so quickly because people can access content of various kinds in an instant. And really, the 21st century and our sort of technological advances have really affected how things become popular and how things, you know, kind of just drop off the map without anybody thinking about them.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to try to connect a few dots here. Yesterday, you were driving around Dr. John Piper in Nashville, and on October 5th, you got published in desiringgod.org. Congratulations, by the way. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Those two things aren't related.
Okay.
But yeah.
Let the record show. Chris Martin has said that.
Yeah. It was the first time that I ever got to write for Desiring God. And I've long admired all the articles on their site and have learned from them a lot.
Yeah, it's a great site. And the title of your article is The Unique Joy of Ordinary Faithfulness. I'm going to give you the last couple of minutes to talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. So a friend of mine who is like the president of Desiring God, his name's John Bloom. I actually spent a summer interning there in 2012. I actually lived in Minneapolis for the summer. It's a great time. It's a great time of year to live there. But I lived there for the summer, and so we had connected a bit, and he emailed me recently and asked me to write something. So I had been reading Ecclesiastes just in like my personal Bible reading time, and I always like to read Ecclesiastes. You know, whatever – Bible reading plan I'm doing for the year.
Mm-hmm.
Usually at the beginning of the year, I decide, okay, am I going to do like read the Bible through a year, or am I going to kind of read individual books, you know, fewer texts at a slower pace and really kind of, you know, try to study them and break them down and things. So this year has been more of a year of studying fewer texts, not doing the Bible in a year thing. But this year, every year I try to read Ecclesiastes at least once, whatever Bible reading plan I've decided to read. And so recently in September, I was reading through Ecclesiastes, and a lot of people find Ecclesiastes to be this like – there's this like joke, this sort of like offhanded joke in the church or in Christian circles where it's like, oh, Ecclesiastes is so depressing. Like he just talks about how everything's pointless all the time. Like who wants to be with that guy? And I think Ecclesiastes is only – really depressing if you're putting your hope in things that aren't going to last.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you really pay attention to Ecclesiastes, yeah, he has – the author of Ecclesiastes has everything you could possibly want in the world from an earthly perspective. He's got houses and vineyards, gardens, fruit trees, this fancy irrigation system, servants and livestock, treasures, singers, all kinds of stuff, everything you could possibly want. And yet he says all is vanity and is striving after the wind. So – that often leads us to depression or sadness of some kind because we're like, well, I'm working so I can get all these cool things. I'm never going to have all the stuff he had. So if Heath says everything's pointless, then what am I even doing with myself?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I talk a lot about the sort of modern age we're in, you know, when I'm on your show with you and sort of like how this technological age affects everything. And it really does. And so I kind of looked at Ecclesiastes as I was reading it through this 21st century lens. And I really think that our constant pursuit of the novel, which innovation is great. Innovation saves lives. I mean, medical technology and all sorts of other technologies that have come about because of innovation is fantastic. All of that's great and common graces of God in our lives along the way. But when we pursue novelty and innovation with this sort of reckless abandon and like this rabid thirst like we have, I feel like we have been since like, you know, since Steve Jobs made a business meeting keynote a worldwide event, which I love. I watch Apple keynotes all the time and I'm fascinated by the whole Apple thing. I've got an iPhone. But since he started making it a business keynote like a worldwide event,
mm-hmm.
It feels to me like we lust almost after novelty and technology. And I think we just need to remind ourselves that the more we can sort of stay to these ancient paths and realize that living a life of ordinary faithfulness is really kind of what we're called to, the novelty and innovation becomes features and tools to help us do that. And we aren't constantly wondering, ooh, what's cool or what's next, or I need to move on to this job or this place. I need to make myself better, and constantly being restless.
Mm.
I think we can be faithful just in where we are. And it seems to me it's becoming constantly harder to do that.
Mm-hmm. Chris, you talk about, it's easy to feel ashamed for living a boring life of faithfulness. And that's just not true at all. I mean, I think we need to have tremendous gratitude in ordinary. I love what I would call a boring day. I sometimes think, oh, I've just had an amazing day. And people would say, why? I go, because it was a little boring.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to, you know, when I was in college, I used to be like, oh, man, I want to do all these things and like make a name for myself and that sort of. I mean, a lot of people feel that way in college. I think they either want to change the world, make a name for themselves, or both. And ever since, you know, I've got my first job and I've gotten kind of into real life after college and gotten married and things like that, I just want to live a normal, quiet life. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sort of seek all of these cool things I maybe once wanted for myself. And I think a lot of times we see people, whether they be famous celebrities or just like well-known Christian leaders that we really admire, and we think, you know, those are the people I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget to be faithful where the Lord has had us. So that Jesus says in Matthew 25:21, well done, good and faithful servant, you have been faithful over little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we just have to be content being faithful over little.
Yes.
When actually, with the right perspective, it may not be little at all.
Yeah. Chris, thanks so much. Have a great weekend, and we'll look forward to having another discussion about the winning Cubs.
I hope so.
All right. It is 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap the show up. Thanks so much for listening today. Thanks to my guests, Chris Martin, Alex McFarland, Sky Jathani. Who's I got to go read that book. I have not read that book, but I do want to see it. And Carmen LaBurge, what a great show. Have a great weekend. See you Monday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.